Hello, this is Jonathan Marks via PCJ Online, just about to push the button on another programme from the Media Network Vintage Radio Archives.
This is Radio Netherlands, the Dutch International Service. Media Network, a weekly review of what's happening in the international communications business, hosted by Diana Janssen and Jonathan Marks.
Hello and welcome as we start this show on the Lucky 13th. Coming up, a look at the past as we review some of the articles surrounding the clandestine radio station of the 1960s, Radio Swan.
We also hear from a delegate to the recent Bluetooth conference in Monaco, who also turns out to be an active Media Network listener. And all being well, we'll bring up the line to Auckland, New Zealand, where Brian Clark has media news from the Pacific.
Remember, we're open for your feedback round the clock from around the world. The email address is media@rnw.nl. And our website now has the easy-to-remember web address as well. www.medianetwork.nl takes you straight to our online webzine that includes an online sound archive of the last 3 months of this programme.
You can phone us on the answer line, 3135 6724 222, or fax the fax to 3135 6724 252.
And last but not least, you can drop us a line to Media Network, Radio Netherlands, Box 222, 1200 JG in Hilversum, the Netherlands. By the way, we'd love to get your holiday postcards if you're away from home this summer. And if you're stuck indoors in the Southern Hemisphere winter, well, drop us a line too, because we've still had too much rain in July for it really to be called summer. Although, knowing Holland, the weather will improve while we're on the air. Eugene Poundstone sent us email from the sunny south of France. A few weeks ago, he joined several thousand delegates at a Bluetooth conference held in Monaco. Eugene thinks we should explain more about the concept and how far things have progressed.
Indeed, this year's conference turned out to be quite good. The idea is to do away with all the cables that are needed to connect devices in the home and office and to come up with a standard language so that devices like phones, organisers and standalone computers can interchange data. The so-called Bluetooth protocol has been in development for 6 years. And proponents now claim that almost 2,000 companies around the world are gradually incorporating the technology into their products. In fact, in a bold move, Sony Electronics announced at the end of June that they'll fit all of their gadgets, such as Walkmans, digital cameras and even their robot, Aibo, with the Bluetooth technology microchip.
Bluetooth transceivers, operating at a frequency of 2.45 GHz, can be integrated into any variety of digital devices, allowing them to communicate without wires or cables. One Bluetooth device can even detect another because it transmits a unique identification over distances up to 10 meters. The idea is that you can use a phone or a handheld organizer to start up automatic transactions for such applications as issuing tickets, food purchases, or simply to identify yourself.
In May, the people behind Bluetooth announced a new logo. It contains the letters H and B, short for Harald Bluetooth. Harald Bluetooth was the Danish king who unified Denmark and Norway in the 10th century. The Danish words have nothing to do with the aftereffects of eating blueberries, though. Bluetooth comes from two Danish words, bla meaning dark-skinned and tan meaning great man. The systems have been developed by Scandinavian companies, although the Dutchman Jaap Hartson is credited here as the father of Bluetooth, driving international committees while working for Ericsson Mobile Communications.
Demonstrations were given in Monte Carlo of new style mobile phones. In the home, the Bluetooth-equipped phone works rather like a cordless phone. It communicates with a base station connected to a fixed phone line. But once you're out of range, the phone switches to mobile GSM technology. And if you come within 10 meters of another Bluetooth-equipped phone, both operate like a walkie-talkie. While it is true that some of this functionality is available with other wireless devices today, the international compatibility issues have only really seriously been addressed by Bluetooth. The system also has been optimized to withstand interference from jammers and uncoordinated co-users. Someone with a portable phone standing outside your house, for instance, can't access your fixed-line Bluetooth phone system inside your home to make calls at your expense.
That's not to say there isn't criticism of it all. The UK cell phone operator Orange has warned the Bluetooth industry about overhyping consumer expectations. Some European operators are not so keen to go through the same experience with Bluetooth that they've already suffered with a hyped introduction of WAP technology. Although gadget freaks are clamouring for the latest, the majority of the general public uses the mobile for simple communication. That's not the same as subscribing to information.
Yes, if you look at the prices being charged in Holland for a simple news headline service to your phone. Well, you could subscribe to a daily newspaper with perhaps 1,000 times more information for the same price. And more extensive teletext services via the television screen are free to air. The Japanese company of TDK has also raised concerns that commercial pressures are leading developers to launch products too soon. These products have only a few of the functions working. Now, this could lead Bluetooth into the same trap that was experienced with infrared protocols. Nice concept, but no working software. At the moment, it is believed that consumers might be willing to pay $40 to $60 extra to have Bluetooth functionality in their cell phones. The number of people using hands-free cell phones is growing significantly, and this demand will supposedly help the early acceptance of Bluetooth.
Award-winning Radio Netherlands, putting features first.
Now, change of subject and to your letters. Dr. Richard Clifford writes from Durban in South Africa.
I've just been taking part in the AIDS conference here in Durban and noted that several international broadcasters took an active part. Radio Netherlands had done a partnership with the Cape Town-based Bush Radio to produce a CD of new music under the label Hiv Hop. Anything that gets the message through is vital in these very trying times in this part of Southern Africa. I really believe you're doing a lot to share vital information with your listeners and at the same time shrug off the stuffy image that many people I know associate with shortwave radio. On a technical note, I expect that your next production will also be available in MP3.
Who knows, bearing in mind the players now available on the market. That's a very good idea, Richard.
Well, mention of MP3 also brings us to an email from Christian Bucks from Munich in Germany.
Bob Tomalski recently said on your programme that MP3 was not really CD-like, unless you have a CD player with really bad speakers. I agree, but for most people, MIDFI will do nicely, thank you. And if the statistics on the MP3 websites are anything to go by, people are not too fussy about quality. We've got a student band here at the university, and MP3 has been a great way for us to get publicity, and even earn some money when we get booked by a local club. I'd also like to support a recent letter writer you had on your show who asked for sound files on your website to be downloadable in MP3. Portable players are becoming affordable here in Germany. Even companies like Grundig, Philips and Sony are offering their own variations. That said, I do find it strange that on the one hand, hardware manufacturers are making these devices, yet record divisions of companies like Sony are worried about copyright. I believe the recent deals with the record company may mean the end of systems like Napster and MP3.com. Do Jonathan and Deanna agree with me?
Well, Christian, the whole issue of copyright and intellectual property rights is a really hot topic at the moment. On the one hand, the European Union is meeting in Strasbourg at the moment, trying to sort out a position. And in the United States, lawyers have been having a field day in the last couple of months as the Recording Industry Association of America and Napster Inc. file claims and counterclaims as to whether a new breed of song exchange technology is harming the global music business, which is worth close to $40 billion a year.
Created by a 19-year-old college student, Sean Fanning, the software is so simple and powerful that Napster has been scaring the world music industry as much as it delights its more than 13 million registered users who've signed up since September last year.
It only takes a few minutes to download a special piece of software from the Napster website. A row of buttons on the top of the screen allows you to search a vast catalogue of nearly 7,500 music collections. The difference is that these music collections are actually on the individual hard drives of Napster members. If you like a particular song, you're actually accessing it from someone's hard drive who's also connected to the internet at that moment.
Round the clock and around the world. Every day there's something different on Radio Netherlands.
Oh, look at that computer. That's the way you do it. Play music. Play your music on your MP3s. That ain't stealing. Everybody's doing it. Get your music for nothing and your hits for free. That ain't crooked. Everybody's doing it. Let me tell you, them kids ain't dumb. They don't give a rip about their favorite singer. They just keep on ripping off their songs. We got to install MP3 players. Labels bitching, losing royalties. Hey, it's got to download, then maybe later. We're gonna burn a dozen CDs.
Now, with the increasing use of ADSL and cable modems in the USA and Canada, it wasn't surprising to find over 750,000 songs were ready for fast download when we checked. And although the software warns you not to break the copyright laws, most of the songs that we could see listed were simply ripped from compact discs and encoded into MP3.
You don't have to be a genius to operate Napster, although the authors haven't spent much money on a slick design. But although Napster is certainly stealing the headlines at the moment, there are other programs out there. iMesh is more sophisticated than Napster because it's not restricted to just music files. You can swap movies or audio clips in any format. But there are not nearly as many users, and we were not alone in having the iMesh program crash a couple of times during the download.
You do have to be a techno nerd, though, to figure out Nutella, a tool for swapping digital files of almost any sort. This was created by programmers working for Nullsoft, a subsidiary of America Online. But the firm abruptly dumped the technology after it realised what pirates could do with it. However, the software wasn't taken down from the website fast enough, and with the space of a couple of hours, 10,000 people downloaded the software and spread Nutella through newsgroups. It installs in less than a minute, but you have to be savvy about the way the internet works if you want to understand what to do after that. For once you've discovered the way to go out and fetch internet protocol addresses, you have to plug them into a blank space on the interface.
There were over 3,000 hosts when we connected just before we came on the air, and more than 250,000 files on offer. Unlike Napster, though, there is no single catalogue of material. For Napster, moved the content of the central web server. Nutella got rid of a central directory. So in theory, no one is watching over your shoulder as to what you're up to, despite some weird messages that occasionally pop up. Because the software allows for completely anonymous file exchange, it's perhaps no wonder that some industry specialists have raised concerns. Nutella and its clones for the Mac and other platforms could become a vehicle for distributing child pornography and pirated software.
So back to Christian Baxter's question. Are Napster and MP3.com doomed in the courts?
Well, the Napster case comes up before the court in San Francisco on July 26th, and we may know after then if they will continue to exist. However, Napster isn't going down without a fight and has hired some prominent expert lawyers to defend their case.
As for MP3.com, well, back in mid-June, two major record labels got the best of all worlds in their settlement of their copyright infringement lawsuit. The settlement with Time Warner Music Group and BMG Entertainment, the music unit belonging to Bertelsmann, cost the San Diego-based company between $15 and $25 million for each label. That cost is going to grow as MP3.com is still in negotiation with three other major labels, Sony Music, Seagram, Universal Music Group and EMI.
But apart from the settlement for the past, MP3 has now agreed to a royalty per song that is downloaded. So rather doubtful that there is a real business model for them to sell directly to the consumer in the long term. In the meantime, some record companies are starting to sell songs online, although few people are going to pay $3 per song that is currently being charged by the bigger sites. Prices just have to come down.
Look at that. That ain't stealing. It's your music on your MP3s. That ain't crooked. Everybody's doing it. Get your music for nothing and your hits for free.
Bob Tomolsky joins us on the line now because he's also been following the MP3 situation and believes there's going to be a format war.
Yes, we all know that people love MP3 and there are plenty of files all over the internet. But did you know there's a whole range of new portable players that will not be using MP3? There's the Sony Memory Stick Walkman, which uses their own flavour of MP3, which of course is incompatible, and that's called Atrac 3. And also recently we've been treated to a sight of the new Panasonic wristwatch type player, which uses AAC, which is another development that's just come from Japan. And all these different players, they're saying they're going to have websites with music encoded to these different standards. But the question is it going to be like Betamax and VHS? Is one going to fall by the wayside and is one going to succeed? Well, clearly MP3 is popular, so all these manufacturers have had to give you extra software, if you like, to decode MP3 into their new standards. The question is, will it all catch on? That we don't know.
But they also, at the same time, want to solve one big problem with MP3, the fact that it's very easy to pirate. There are two versions of the memory stick, aren't there? One you can copy, one you can't.
Indeed, yes. In the past, MP3 has had a culture for copying. Everybody's been talking about, you know, distributing music illegally. But now we're moving on to a new phase, which uses a thing called SDMI. That stands for the Secure Digital Music Initiative, which means that the music posted on the websites will be encrypted and can only be downloaded and decrypted by players that conform to the new standard. Now, Sony's memory stick uses a new type of memory stick called MG, Magic Gate. And what's the purpose of the new memory card? Well, basically, that has the technology built in for encryption and decryption, whereas the old memory stick did not have that. So if you look at the latest portable player from Sony, it will only work with the new MG memory sticks, which are white in colour, and not the older blue ones, which didn't have the encryption capability.
Now, Bob, you have to confess, do you actually have Napster yourself?
Indeed, I do. And I've been looking at some of the tracks on Napster and looking at what's happening. And, of course, the argument with Napster, from Napster's point of view, they're doing nothing illegal. All they're doing is operating a server that allows people to be put into contact with each other. And if those people want to swap copyright music, then that's up to them. They say, really, the purpose for Napster is for musicians to swap their own files, their own home-created music, and distribute their music on the Internet. But, of course, everybody knows that really MP3 is a copy type culture and people are using it for distributing illegal music copies.
On his side of the North Sea, Bob believes that MP3 hasn't really harmed sales of older material.
I think some people are using Napster to download, if you like, collections of music that they might have had in their youth and which they're now recollecting using Napster. But I think as far as affecting the latest chart sales, no, I don't think so. I think, you know, bear in mind that MP3, although the quality is good, it's not CD quality. And for those people that want to get the very best in terms of audio, they would be prepared to buy the CD and cough up for it at the inflated prices.
Bob, thanks for joining us.
Now to a letter from David Trimble, who lives in Madison, Wisconsin in the USA.
Just a note to say, I enjoyed your recent coverage from Montreal on the Challengers Conference. Sounds like Radio Netherlands is leading the pack again when it comes to finding the right niche for international radio. I fear that some other broadcasters won't make it in time. They just don't bother, or maybe they simply can't afford to make features sound acoustically interesting. I also appreciated Diana Janssen's talk with your gadget guru about the double-sided speak that Philips is throwing out concerning DVD.
Well, thanks for those comments, David. We're blushing here in the studio. Nice to know we're on the right track.
Psychological warfare has been a part of US government strategy in international conflict situations over many decades. On the Media Network web scene, Andy Sennett notes that it's exactly 40 years since the establishment of the first anti-Castro radio station, the so-called Black Clandestine Radio Swarm, a forerunner of the current radio and television Marti. For many years, the operation was shrouded in official secrecy, but thanks to the declassification of certain US government documents, the full story is now in the public domain.
And it's fascinating, for on the 17th of March 1960, US President Eisenhower approved a covert action program to bring about the replacement of the Castro regime in Cuba. Propaganda was a very important element of the program, and the Central Intelligence Agency was asked to set up a high-powered radio station outside the continental United States and have it ready for operation within 60 days. Operating such a station wasn't cheap. It was budgeted at $900,000 for fiscal year 1961.
The CIA selected Swan Island in the Gulf of Mexico as the transmitter site. The island was claimed by both the USA and Honduras. The original plan was to operate Radio Swan as a clandestine station, but the US Navy, having been involved in the transportation of equipment to Swan Island, decided it did not wish to be associated with a clandestine operation. So Radio Swan went on the air in May 1960 as a commercial station, ostensibly owned by the Gibraltar Steamship Company, a bogus company set up by the CIA as a front for the operation.
Radio Swan used medium wave 1160 kHz with a power of 50 kilowatts and also had a 7.5 kilowatt shortwave transmitter operating on exactly 6 megahertz. The medium wave transmitter had early been used by Radio Free Europe but had become surplus to requirements. Broadcasts were entirely in Spanish and airtime was sold to various Cuban exile groups. The station itself identified as Radio Swan, the international voice of the Caribbean. Now, because the station operated in a period before cheap means of home recording had been invented, such as the cassette, there are apparently no surviving recordings of the station in private archives. Although government archives contain a lot of paper, there's simply no tape that we've yet come across.
In an attempt to disguise the true identity of the station, the Federal Communications Commission in Washington, D.C. denied all knowledge of its existence, despite being on territory claimed by the United States. The station's signals reached not just Cuba, but the entire Caribbean. Indeed, the shortwave signal was logged regularly in Europe. The Cubans jammed the station, but, according to American government reports, the jamming was only effective in the area around Havana.
Cuba responded by broadcasting its own anti-American radio service called La Voz de Imra, which meant the voice of the National Institute of Agrarian Reform. It used the same frequency as Radio Swan. Crisis gradually worsened, and on January the 3rd, 1961, the United States officially broke off diplomatic relations with Cuba. 1 month later, Cuba began broadcasting its official overseas service, Radio Havana Cuba.
Esta es Radio Havana Cuba.
Transmitiendo desde Cuba, territorio libre en América.
During the 60s, Radio Havana also launched some programs which could be regarded as separate clandestine radio stations, although three times a week wasn't exactly the best way to build a loyal audience. WRUL, a shortwave station with studios in New York, ran this item on its media show at the time.
Radio New York Worldwide. Hi everyone, this is Steve Silverstein. First to that news item. For some months now, DXers throughout the United States have been reporting that they've heard a station calling itself Radio Free Dixie on 690. That's 690 kilocycles. The programs heard consist mainly of jazz and accounts of atrocities against the American Negroes. The MC of Radio Free Dixie is Robert F. Williams, and he fled the United States to avoid prosecution for rape. The station stated that their transmitters were donated to them by Radio Progreso, located in Havana, Cuba. The station's ID is, "We are coming to you from Havana, free territory of the Americas." And the station operates on Fridays from 0400 to 0500, and Sunday and Tuesday from 0500 to 0600.
See what I mean? Ironically, the same station, WRUL, Radio New York Worldwide, was also broadcasting the CIA programs in Spanish from Radio Swan as part of a commercial distribution deal that it had done.
Although the broadcasts of Radio Swan were initially quite successful, the station soon suffered as a result of its policy of selling airtime to different Cuban exile groups. These groups just promoted their own interests and often exaggerated things so much that the station's credibility began to get severely damaged.
But a US military operation against Cuba was about to be launched, the notorious Bay of Pigs invasion. The CIA couldn't allow the uncoordinated programming of Radio Swan to undermine the station's other role, which was to provide tactical support to military forces in the form of coded messages. So in late March, the ostensible owner of the Swan Island radio station thanked all the sponsors of political programs and advised them that no more tapes would be required. The whole programming strategy was then drastically changed. Radio Swan started broadcasting a mainly news format, along with programming designed to assist those who were fighting Castro within Cuba.
The station's output was massively increased, and at its peak it was operating on 14 frequencies. A CIA paper prepared in April 1961 noted that medium and shortwave broadcasting in opposition to Castro was being carried on 7 stations in addition to Radio Swan. The Bay of Pigs plan included additional broadcasts from transmitters aboard 3 boats to ensure blanket coverage to all parts of the island virtually at all times.
The actual military operation was a disaster, partly because one part of the US armed forces was using Greenwich Mean Time, the other was working on Eastern Standard Time. When it became obvious that the main attack on Cuba had been unsuccessful, Radio Swan quickly admitted that the mission had failed, but it also claimed that many of the freedom fighters had been able to join resistance groups in the hills. Radio Swan then reduced its broadcasting hours and its revolutionary tone.
Later in 1961, the station changed its name to Radio Americas, and it continued to broadcast until one day in May 1968, when it went off the air and was never heard again. The 50-kilowatt medium-wave transmitter was shipped to Vietnam, where it gave further service during the United States' next great military adventure.
And pictures to illustrate that story have been posted on our website. Brian Clark joins us now with an update on the broadcasting situation in Australia.
Well, there's certainly been quite a flurry of concern, Jonathan, about the fact that Radio Australia may not be able to reuse those facilities at Darwin. They lost them back in 1997 because of budget cuts. But the latest news is that Christian Voice and Radio Australia are in dialogue over purchase of airtime for the Darwin transmitters. And the parent organisation in Great Britain, the Christian Vision, has been quoted as saying that they would be prepared to look at leasing out excess airtime at cost. But I personally think that the stumbling block for Radio Australia is again going to be funding. They have a relay broadcast from Taiwan at this time, beaming into Indonesia, but the lease there expires in August, and both Radio Australia and the Australian Broadcasting Corporation are saying they have no funds to extend the Taiwanese relay. So it will be questionable whether funding would be available for additional relays through Darwin. But meantime, I believe the Christian Voice should be on air from Australia around about September of this year.
Join us in 7 days. Bye for now.
I've been doing some listening between 3 and 30 megawatts. It's, some people get static, some people get far-off countries. I just get a headache.
Serving the universe from Flevo, Radio Netherlands, with relays in Russia, Bonaire, and Madagascar. Any questions?
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website, where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.